The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. This week,
I've been wondering what that special place in hell looks like for those who promoted Brexit without even a sketch of a plan how to carry it safely.
Those who sold Brexit without a proper plan deserve a special place in hell, said Donald Tusk yesterday. And as the hell of a no-deal Brexit inches ever closer, that proper plan remains as elusive as ever. As we speak, Theresa May is in Brussels, the first time she's met the EU top brass since the deal she agreed with them was roundly rejected by Parliament. And last night, Jeremy Corbyn put his own cards on the table, laying out five tests May would have to meet for Labour to back her Brexit deal. So can Theresa May finally find a way through the Brexit impasse? Also this week, we hear from SNP MP Stuart MacDonald about his campaign to take on dodgy employers. And as plans for a sculpture of Margaret Thatcher are approved in her hometown of Grantham, we ask what could possibly go wrong. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, as we record this, Theresa May is in Brussels for an awkward meeting with European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker, followed by a potentially even more awkward one with President of the European Council Donald Tusk. Last week's Brady Amendment paved the way for the PM to have another go at getting changes to the Irish backstop, despite the EU having already told her there'll be no movement on the issue. "We will not gamble with peace or put a sell-by date on reconciliation," Tusk confirmed yesterday. So what May hopes to achieve by today's meeting, no one on either side really seems to know. But I'm hoping that today's expert panel will be able to elucidate. I'm joined by The Guardian's Jonathan Friedland, Dawn Foster and Patrick Winter. Hello all. So, Patrick, what is the point of this trip, do you think, from Downing Street's point of view? They told us yesterday that Theresa May's taking any of three plans with her for reforming the backstop.
Well, I understand it. She's taking all three plans and she's not actually going to advocate any of them. To me, what we're seeing over the last fortnight really is just filling in time and hoping the clock runs down until she can get to that point where Parliament is faced with the dilemma of her deal or no deal. And I think that's always what her operation has been, and she's just keeping that clock ticking, and MPs are spending their time discussing antisocial behaviour, drinking and sport in three separate debates, although they could all have been put into one since they're all linked. But I think there's nothing substantive happening in Parliament and there's not a lot happening in government.
Jolly, that's right, isn't it? This seems to be part of a sort of effort to prolong or delay the crunch point. We've had a number of moments that were meant to be the crunch point, and next week again we're going to see some votes increasingly looking as if that's not going to be the crunch point either.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I think it's all, in a way, not just May. I mean, you talk to the various players in this drama and all of them had a strategy, including the People's Vote people, which was we want to get to the point where all the other options are eliminated and then it's our preferred course of action versus the horror of no deal. So you just have to wait out that process of elimination, actually, of all the other things being not there, and the kind of concentration of minds that comes from being about to fall off a cliff. So we are in this strange sort of phony war till the end of March. I agree with that. I mean, I think the other thing that's just can't pass without sort of judgment about Theresa May is this notion of going to Europe without herself a proactive proposal for how you solve this problem. So she said, she told the House of Commons, was it last week or last century? It already feels so long ago.
I think it was still last week.
Vote against my deal that I told you could never be changed. Vote against it, please, because we want to ditch the backstop. She goes to Brussels to say, look, they've ditched the backstop. And they're waiting for her to say, and here's what I want you to approve instead. Instead, she's gone to them and said, please come up with some alternative. And that's been a hallmark all the way through, this kind of passivity, where the expectation has been we present to Brussels the problem and all our red lines and they say, well, look, here's a solution. Well, I think it would have been more effective if she'd gone to Brussels and say, here's what we want.
Meanwhile, Patrick, she's also keeping quite a lot of Tory backbenchers busy, isn't she, by, there's an alternative arrangements working group. That phrase, alternative arrangements, was in this amendment. Seems to mean different things to different people, but she's got a group of MPs busily popping in and out of Whitehall to talk to civil servants and ministers about their brilliant technological solutions. Again, it's all part of running down the clock, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think she's trying to flatter a group of MPs that need to be flattered. I mean, I think it's without being rude about any of them individually or their intellects. I just think it's slightly ridiculous that at this very, very 98th hour, 99th hour, they are going to come up with a new proposal on the Northern Ireland border that hasn't been thought of by anyone else prior to that. I mean, I liken it to that this group have finally identified where the store of deck chairs are on the Titanic, and they're going to go and they've got a range of plans about whether
to put
them on the upper deck or the lower deck, but they're not going to come into, you know, no detailed proposals at the moment. I mean, it seems to be just a form of displacement activity.
Dawn, Labour's not been averse to the odd bit of displacement activity at various points during this past 2 years or so, has it? Jeremy Corbyn's latest gambit is a letter that he published last night setting out his kind of Brexit and the conditions that he would require to back the Prime Minister.
I mean, I think that the letter is a better move away from the six tests, which were kind of largely unworkable in the same way that the red lines were. I don't think anything was ever going to get through that would pass the six tests. So I think that moving on to the new demands that are actually quite workable and could see Brexit moving forward is a good way forward.
One of those tests, we should say, these are Keir Starmer's six tests, and one of those was that any deal had to deliver the exact same benefits, in quotes, as membership of the customs union in the single market.
Yeah, so I think it's good that we've moved away from them. And if you look quite closely, they, you know, the new demands that Jeremy Corbyn set out are deliverable. I think he's still dealing with parts of his party who do want a second referendum. And I think at this point, the majority of people I speak to accept that's not going to happen. And what they want is no deal to be taken off the table, people to focus more on that. So I think it's interesting that the second referendum people are still quite vocal when the majority of people that I speak to and the majority of politicians I speak to are focused on trying to stop no deal from happening and do fully accept for the most part that Brexit will still go ahead. But
it's all about keeping options in play, though, isn't it? That no deal option, Labour has repeatedly said, take it off the table, take it off the table. It's in Theresa May's interest to keep it in play, isn't it? Even though it's extraordinarily risky to do so.
Yeah, she wants to keep it in play so she can scare people on her own side and on Labour to say, you better just go with Brexit because the alternative is crashing out with no deal. So she needs it there to make people accept hers as the lesser of two evils. So she needs the other evil to be there glaring. But I think the significance of the Corbyn thing shouldn't be underestimated. That letter is significant, partly for the reason Dawn says, which is that the six tests were almost designed, I think Stephen Bush makes this point today, that they were almost designed to be unmeetable, hence the exact same benefits. And whereas these are designed to be highly meetable, and it suggests that Jeremy Corbyn does actually want to play that role of enabling Brexit. Now, some people will give him plaudits for that because he could be the guy who averted no deal, you know, and get credit for that. On the other hand, it means in that big calculation where he's been on the fence all the way through, or tried to be, he is ultimately saying, look, the group I'm going to disappoint will be Remainers, not Leavers. And it is interesting that this comes just as there is this leaked polling, The Guardian broke, from the TSSA union that says disappointing Remainers exacts a real electoral cost for Labour. Now, we don't know that. You can't have hypothetical polling, really. But the notion that, you know, it can't be overlooked that what was those figures that we had, I think, or that were measured in polling, 87-90% of Labour members are Remainers. The overwhelming majority of Labour voters, even in Leave areas, are pro-Remain. There could be dire consequences for saying, in the end, we are going to be the midwives of Brexit rather than committing ourselves by whatever means to somehow stopping it. So that's a big shift.
Yeah, and it feels, Dawn, doesn't it, as though it's another one of those moments where quite a lot of the activists that are very keen on Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, also very pro-Remain. And it feels to me as if, I feel, every time we write one of these stories that says, you know, Jeremy Corbyn says we'd try and renegotiate Brexit and then go ahead with it, or, you know, Jeremy Corbyn writes to the Prime Minister to say, here's the kind of Brexit we want, there's a kind of fearful backlash from MPs who say, but we should be stopping Brexit. You know, you feel that at some point it's going to become clear that Jeremy Corbyn will stop Brexit. He's not in that game, is he? That's not what he wants to do.
I mean, I don't think he ever has been. I think it's been quite clear from the beginning that, you know, the Labour leadership accepted that the vote happened. Even, you know, it shouldn't have gone ahead. David Cameron's error will hopefully haunt him. But once it happened, obviously, Labour, you know, said they accepted the vote, they'd move forward.
It's not true of many, many MPs, though, is it? And many of the party's activists.
No, but I think the issue is that, I mean, most of my, for instance, nearly all of my friends are Remainers. Most of my friends are kind of under 35. But I don't know anybody who doesn't accept that Brexit should go ahead. And also, when I look at the majority of people I know and the majority of people I speak to, regardless of where they voted on Brexit, it's not the only issue they vote on. And I think often that kind of gets lost, and people talk about voters purely in Remain and Brexit terms, as if that's the only thing they ever vote on. And if a general election comes up, it will purely be another referendum. When people vote on schools, on education, on the economy, and very, very few people see Brexit as the only issue that they look at. Again, the majority of my friends, majority of people I know voted for Remain. They have different levels of criticism of the EU, but every single person accepts that we are leaving because the majority of people voted for it.
So you think the leadership is right to be to sort of shrug off some of these hypothetical polls and to be relaxed about the idea that some members would like them to be in a different place on Brexit, because when it comes to it, when it came to a general election, those people would still, you think those young voters would still support Labour?
I think that a focus on trying to overturn a referendum, especially when the parliamentary arithmetic isn't there, would be very, very dangerous, both electorally and in the longer term for society in Britain.
Patrick, is there any way through for the idea of a second referendum without the support of the Labour front bench, do you think? It seems to me there have been a number of moments where the People's Vote campaign have said, if Theresa May's deal is rejected, there'll be a surge in support and suddenly we'll get a majority in Parliament. Or if X happens or if Y happens, and we're very close to the line now and we haven't got there.
Yeah, I think the People's Vote sort of was predicated on the idea that it could persuade the Labour leadership, and it poured about £1 million into polling to show why it would be damaging to the Labour leadership if they didn't support Remain. And they poured a lot of effort into the party conference and ended up with a compromise which, in essence, gave Jeremy Corbyn a get-out. And then I think it was a disaster for them when the amendment by Yvette Cooper didn't go through, because that would have opened the way for a delay in the process of Article 50. So I think they've really been hammered in the last 2 weeks. And arguably, their attempt to try and persuade opinion formers inside the Labour Party or to work with people like Keir Starmer and Tom Watson has been mistaken, and they should have been much more aggressive with the Labour leadership from the start.
Aggressive
in saying that Jeremy Corbyn is a Lexiteer, that he doesn't support staying inside the European Union, and really being, rather than trying to persuade him, just trying to expose him. And I don't think the strategy they've used worked. I slightly agree with Dawn that when you come to a general election, although we're all Remain Leave now and everyone says polls show that's how we identify ourselves, when we're in a two-party system and you're faced with going to vote Tory or Labour, and that's the realistic choice you face in many, many seats, people will revert back to Labour, and even though they're cross with him about what he's done. And I'm sure he will try to manoeuvre these votes that come up so that his fingerprints are as far away from the actual moment when the UK leaves, and there may be just that there's a rebellion by a group of 20, 30 Labour MPs.
So Theresa May's deal might, or some version thereof, might go through, but without Jeremy Corbyn actively
saying, basically what
we'll whip to support it.
We're now down to two options. These are the two frontrunners now. Having been a point at which he was going to be either second vote or no deal, I think we're now down to a version of her deal, or basically the Norway 2.0, which is what is in the Corbyn letter. Mm. One last thing about the Corbyn letter is it does have an element about there needing to be a legal requirement, a bill that would enforce what he's suggesting. And I just find it really hard to imagine Theresa May accepting that.
Yeah. Does that sound right? It's both about... That I think is an insurance policy against a future Tory leader. It's not only does she have to go back to Brussels and renegotiate the political declaration, the forward-looking bit of the deal to deliver all these extra promises, but she then has to pass some piece of legislation which commits her to to that framework. And so it wouldn't allow, for example, Boris Johnson or Michael Gove to take over in April or May or June and sweep it all away.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was wise to make that demand because you can't bet on her being there for very long. And so you want that in statute. But he did. I read it in a similar way to Patrick, which is Jeremy Corbyn has kept sufficient wiggle room in that letter for him to pull away whenever he wants to, because there's a lot in there that can be, can be said no to. And I think the whole business of the customs union, you know, we're gliding over that, but there is a whole chunk of Tory support that drops off the minute she would inch towards Corbyn's position.
Which is absolutely why she's taken the approach that she has. She's desperate not to split her party lose all those votes from that side, from the right wing of her party.
Exactly. Yeah. So if she shuffles a sort of few inches to the left to meet Jeremy Corbyn on customs union, she loses a whole flank on her right. And then you're into quite an interesting calculation of within Labour of who would vote with it and who wouldn't. And the numbers could get very tight, where the combination of ERG people, Brexit, you know, hard Brexiters on the Rees-Mogg wing, they drop off, and then proper Remainers in Labour who wouldn't vote for a countenance it because it's still Brexit. Can the numbers get tight that way? So this is far from the final act, but it is a step by Corbyn towards saying, OK, we're going to have to make Brexit happen.
Yeah. Patrick, what's Mr. Tusk up to yesterday in Brussels with these rather colourful remarks? Do you think, is it just a bit of sort of theatre, or does it display genuine exasperation? What's going on there?
I think he's actually quite an emotional figure, and I think he cares a great deal about this long negotiation. He doesn't see it as a kind of technical negotiation. He thinks it will define the future of Europe, and I think it reflected an exasperation with not just Theresa May, but with Jeremy Corbyn. And I don't think that bit of his remarks, which were much longer than the special place in hell, have been picked over as much as they should.
Yeah, he said there was no political force and no effective leadership for Remain, didn't he?
Yes. I think you've got to remember that the European Union is facing these parliamentary elections very shortly, where there's going to be a huge battle between the sort of populist forces and the pro-European forces. And he's trying to set some dividing lines on that as well. But there is just an absolute frustration that here we are so close to the finishing line, and the British government doesn't know whether it wants to be on the racetrack or not.
I thought with Tusk, it's really interesting, because some people have thought the very fact that the remarks were tweeted afterwards shows this was a deliberate intervention and very careful, you know, deliberate move by him. I'm not so sure that's right, because I think that I had a look at his Twitter feed, and what they tend to do is they tweet things after he said them, as if, you know, just summary of his day.
Yeah, I think that's right, yeah.
So it could have been, exactly as Patrick was saying, a sort of moment of exasperation. I think, you know, it has to be said, even though it's sort of wearing to have to do it, it's been written up here as if he was saying, you Brits deserve a special place in hell. He was really focused on that group of Brexiters who'd never offered a plan for how it could be done safely. Very interesting word to use, safely. Mm. And so his sights are Boris Johnson and Rees-Mogg and Farage and Michael Gove, rather than the 17.4 million. So that needs to be said. But he then did say this other thing, which I think is so significant, where he did say, look, the trouble is both the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition want Brexit. And if you put together both remarks, he was breaking a kind of taboo in British politics. He was saying two things that are often not said.
Sort of interfering in domestic politics almost.
I think the reason why it was so shocking was that, look, obviously the Leavers want to have a displacement activity and an excuse to talk about something else. So they've got 24 hours of doing little devil drawings.
Being outraged,
about Tusk and being outraged. That's fine. But the two taboo things are, first, hardly anybody ever calls out Johnson and Gove and Farage for all their impossible promises. It is striking that Labour and Corbyn, when they attack Brexit, they attack Theresa May. They say it's your bad Brexit deal. They don't say this whole argument was premised on a false prospectus, on a false offer. You very rarely hear that. So he was calling out the hard Brexiters, rare to do that. And the second thing, I'm afraid, was to say, look, both the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition are in this together, and they're doing it. And again, it's become a sort of polite convention in Labour circles to sort of pretend that Jeremy isn't for it. But actually, that is the reality, and this letter today or last night makes it even clearer. So I think just part of the reaction is it takes somebody outside often just to state the obvious, and that's what he did, and people don't like it.
Don, why do you think no leadership has emerged for the Remain cause, as it were? There are, as you say, lots of voters, lots of young people. Many of them might be Labour members, or they might be attached to other parties who do quite like the cause of Remain. Why have we not? I mean, for example, why have the Liberal Democrats, which is the one clearly anti-Brexit party, not managed to pick up more of that support?
I think it speaks, to go back to the referendum. One of the reasons that Remain lost is because nobody made a good enough argument for staying in the European Union. It's very, very hard to come up with a really vital and kind of attractive campaign for what is essentially a trading bloc. And often when you then speak about it to other people, you know, leavers, etc., say, well, you know, the only reason you want to stay is because you like having foreign holidays. And I think the Remain camp were always very poor at making the argument for EU membership, and they still haven't fully managed to do it. So there's that. But also, the Liberal Democrats have just completely fallen away with young people. They're completely panicking about the fact that they can pretty much fit their shadow cabinet in a large taxi. But also, I think that if we had ended up just relitigating the referendum, we would end up in as kind of stagnating a place as the Democrats are in America. If you look at, you know, US politics, so many people still haven't moved on from Trump's election. They still can't come to terms with the fact that he won. And I think that a lot of people in the UK, rather than constantly try and go back to the referendum, say it wasn't won on fair terms, we need to have it again, etc., they have just focused on the fact that we need to accept it and move on, because otherwise politics will never continue in that way.
Patrick, why is leadership for this cause not emerged? It's not Jeremy Corbyn. It was probably never going to be Jeremy Corbyn. Why has someone else not emerged onto the scene to make this argument that clearly resonates with a lot of people?
Well, I don't agree about there not being any passion for Europe and that it's just a trading bloc. I actually think people, maybe even over the last 2 years, have come to think differently about Europe, and that they realise it represents a set of values and which they respect. And it's also about standing up to the kind of racism that was inherent in the Leave campaign. So I think there's actually a lot of passion about Europe. And there were 700,000 people on a march not that long ago, and every member of the Shadow Cabinet managed to find a kind of drafty Labour committee room to sit in on that day to avoid being on that march, which I thought was, you know, disgraceful. And I actually just think the whole way in which the Labour leadership has failed to embrace this has been appalling. And at one point, they wanted to reject every aspect of the European Union except free movement, which is the one unpopular aspect of the European Union. I find their whole position illogical, and it's been very frustrating that Jeremy Corbyn, who's obviously so popular with the Labour Party membership, is so unpopular on the issue that really matters. It drives me, sometimes it drives me to despair that we've ended up with this quality of leadership on both sides of the fence. As to why no one else has appeared, well, we live in a two-party system. The Liberal Democrats are damaged for various reasons. I don't think Vince Cable is a really kind of, he's a good shadow chancellor. He's not a leader of a party. And a lot of the most articulate arguments been made about the European Union have been made by Tony Blair, who's obviously, you know, the worst messenger you can have in the UK at present. But if you actually read his speeches and discard the fact that they've been said by him, they are incredibly persuasive. But it needs a ventriloquist for someone else to be saying it.
Can the two-party system hold, do you think? It's a big question, but we keep reading about the potential for Labour MPs who feel the frustration that Patrick's voicing there to take themselves away, to resign the whip, to form a different group.
I mean, the slightly turning your question around, the power of the two-party system, oddly, has been demonstrated by these last 2 years, partly for the reason Patrick just said, which is our two-party system exerts such an iron grip that it means even in a situation like this, where we know 48% feel differently from the two main parties, there is no natural outlet for that. The thing that puzzles me a lot is that, occasionally I do this programme for the radio about the comparing past and present, and one of the things...
Really? You can plug it. It's fine.
It's called The Long View.
And is it? That really? On Radio 4. When's it go out?
9 o'clock on Tuesdays.
I'm looking forward to it.
But the point about it is we so often do parallels with the 19th century, and in there, all the time, there are new formations that come up and people, whole wings break off. It happens routinely. So there was one big argument where there were people, the whole hoggers versus the half hoggers. They wanted to go the whole hog and the half hog. Very similar to Brexit about imperial preference. The point is, things were quite fluid then and people did break off and form new factions. And in this situation, you know, 19th century politicians, somebody would have just emerged, put a flag down, and a whole group, 150 MPs, would have gone around, rallied around them. And it's just an interesting thing about modern Our modern political system, it might be to do with, you know, the universal franchise. It might be to do with media. I don't quite know what. It will take a political scientist to explain why it's so much more rigid now than then. Because this is exactly a situation made for the, you know, hung parliament where commons would be fluid. And 200 years ago, we would not be in this situation. We'd have cracked it. And instead, people have stayed absolutely in their kind of rigid regiments on Tory and Labour, despite this issue really testing that to breaking point. It hasn't broken.
I think I can think of at least a dozen people who think they might be that person who will go out and plant the flag, and others will rally behind them, but they haven't done it. And if they did so, whether enough people would follow to make it viable, I don't know. Thank you all. We'll be back after this.
In today's non-stop world, making quality time for yourself is more important than ever. When you buy a subscription to The Guardian and The Observer, you can look forward to sitting back and leafing through every page at your own pace. From the latest groundbreaking investigations to recipes, reviews, award-winning sports coverage, and more. Plus, we're now offering an additional 50% off our 3-month subscriptions, only when you subscribe before the 17th of February. Just search Guardian Subscriptions.
Now, while the government is preoccupied with delivering Brexit, some backbench MPs are busy trying to force them to act on some of those burning injustices Theresa May claims to be keen on eliminating. SNP Stuart MacDonald has made it his mission to ban unpaid work trials and held a debate this week on the issue in Westminster. I asked him about it.
It's a part of the working economy that everybody knows goes on, the unpaid trial period, but nobody really talks about. It's that part between applying for a job and getting a formal offer for the job, where you're maybe asked to come in and do the job for a period of time. Sometimes it could be an hour or 2 hours. In some of the more extreme cases, it can be 40 hours, for which you are not paid. And that strikes me as fundamentally unfair, completely against the spirit of the Minimum Wage Act from 1998, and needs to be fixed.
And how widespread is it? How did you come across it as an issue?
Well, I originally came across it because there was a company who operated across the UK. Their Glasgow store had offered one of my constituents' nieces an unpaid working trial for 40 hours. That's a full, you know, 9-to-5 working week.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
With no expenses, no pay, no travel expenses, nothing at all, to try out for a job that in the end she might not even get. And then on doing kind of talking more about this and doing more research into it, I started to uncover all sorts of really ugly practices. So it's not unusual for companies to advertise a job with a trial period when a job doesn't even exist. It's actually about covering staff shortages or holidays or busy periods, perhaps over Christmas, for example.
And is that not illegal under current law?
I don't believe the law is clear on it. The government argues that the law is clear on it. If it was clear on it and it was illegal, then it begs the question, why has there never been a single prosecution or fine in 20 years of the Minimum Wage Act for this kind of thing happening to people? And it's the kind of thing that everybody knows it goes on. Everybody's either done an unpaid trial shift, I've done it myself, or you know someone who has done an unpaid trial shift, but nobody was ever really doing anything about it. To be entirely fair, there's a wider movement, particularly within Unite Union. They've got their excellent hospitality charter, which looks at this and other issues about, you know, the distribution of staff tips, for example, and various other things. You know, they've been working on this for a while.
But is it mainly in that kind of industry, in hospitality? And
I found it's been in kind of, hospitality, retail, it's in journalism as well. But it largely, the cases I've come across have been hospitality and retail. So whilst the unions have kind of recognised this as an issue, to be fair, for quite some time, Parliament hasn't until I brought the bill in just after the last general election.
And what happened then?
Well, the bill was brought in and I got the best part of a year to write the bill, to draft the bill. And despite assurances from the government that they weren't going to talk it out and kill it via procedure, I'm afraid to say they did just that and talk the bill out in March of last year. This is the first chance I've had to raise the issue again in a kind of formal parliamentary debate. But I'm of the view it's not going to go away. The government have since killing the bill brought out guidelines which are utterly unenforceable, So there's clearly an admission that this is a problem and something needs to happen. It's just that what they've done so far doesn't go anywhere near close to solving the actual problem.
And what is the prospect of it becoming law once you stand up today and bring it back?
Very little. Today is just a debate, to be fair. It's not a motion. There's not a vote or anything like that. What I'm really trying to do is urge the government to bring forward legislation. They're out of ideas. They need ideas. We hear that the Prime Minister...
They're a bit busy, I think.
They're a bit busy, but we hear the Prime Minister's keen on improving workers' rights. You know, it's time for the government to put its money where its mouth is and bring forward something either before the next Queen's speech or in the next Queen's speech to end this really quite vile and horrible exploitation that is going on, and people want to pretend it isn't.
And you sound like you're not going to let it drop.
No, definitely not.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Stuart MacDonald there. Now, plans for a statue of Margaret Thatcher in her hometown of Grantham have been approved, despite concerns it may be vandalised. The sculpture was offered to Grantham after the original plans for it to be erected in Parliament Square in Westminster were rejected. The 10-foot-high statue will be placed on a granite plinth of the same height. But will this be enough to deter vandals? Dawn, you've written about this. What could possibly go wrong?
I think the main thing at the moment is everybody, you know, post-Gatwick is thinking about drones. So, you know, they are very, very worried about vandals. And as soon as Grantham announced that they wanted to take the statue and they would put it on a, you know, a 10-foot-high plinth to deter vandals, obviously the first thing that a lot of vandals said were, you know, we can be a lot more creative. And I think, you know, if you put an obstacle in people's path, if you try and stop people from doing something, you know, a do not climb sign anywhere, people will just try and do the exact opposite.
It sounds a bit like the solution to the Irish border, to be honest. Is there something rather sad, though, Johnny, about the fact that she was first female prime minister? You know, it's her hometown. Not surprising, some people might feel proud of her.
It's good that it's in the hometown. I mean, you know, there is a statue for Harold Wilson in Huddersfield. You know, the hometown should have first claim. I think that's fine. I think, look, probably it shows you the power of the living memory is strong. And in two generations or three generations, there will be a statue for her in Parliament Square. And maybe because it is, you know, still radioactive in terms of people alive, miners whose lives and communities were ruined, for example, in the miner strike, and blame her still, it is too live it hasn't yet passed. And I don't think she'd have wanted it to have passed. She hasn't passed yet into bland consensus. You know, she's not that sort of figure who's been drained of all politics and about whom everyone can unite. And I think that's probably what she'd have wanted. So Grantham for now, but I would guess if we were meeting again around this table in 100 years' time, there'll be a statue for her in Westminster.
Statues of politicians seem to be rather out of fashion, Patrick. Is that fair? We don't seem to quite revere today's politicians in quite the way that we once did. And indeed, it's a certain amount of tearing down of statues that goes on these days, isn't there? Cecil Rhodes and...
Yes, and also like in America, huge debate about the statues and sort of the role of the Confederacy. Actually, many of those statues were put up in the 1920s, way after the Civil War, and probably reflected a kind of different controversy at the time. But I think statues are incredibly important. In fact, when I form my breakaway party, the first thing I'm going to do is have a major review of all the statues in London and remove all these kind of pointless military generals who've probably were involved in appalling colonial acts of terrorism. And
who are you going to put up instead? I'm intrigued now.
Who would I put up? Soft power people. People who really do represent modern Britain.
Go on.
Footballers.
Footballers, oh God. I was quite briefly in favour of Patrick's breakaway party then.
He lost us then, didn't he? With footballers. We were with you. No, I like the statue of George Orwell that's now outside Broadcasting House, for example, and maybe that would be the sort of thing you mean in terms of soft power.
Blue plaques. So if we look at the blue plaque again and see the people on there and whether we should be putting those more into a sort of statue form.
So but sort of cultural
Yeah, cultural
icons,
figures. When I was saying soft power, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
I find blue plaques catch my eye a lot more than statues do. Statues just seem kind of relatively bland. Occasionally I might look at who they are, Google them, etc. Whereas every time I go past the blue plaque, I'll look at it and I'll, you know, I learn what the person did there. I'll often look them up and, you know, I find they catch my eye a lot more. I learn a lot more from them. You know, they're quite small. They don't take up a huge amount of space. And it's a small kind of nod to somebody's life and part of somebody's life rather than just a single commemoration.
So essentially the blue plaque thing doesn't in any way suggest the person is necessarily being honoured. It's
no,
just
completely.
Recorded. So where I lived 20 years ago, there was a plaque for V.I. Lenin, who had lived on Percy Circus for not, you know, in central London for a few years. It wasn't saying, isn't he a great thing or isn't he not a great thing?
Sometimes they've just They're passed just saying, through, haven't
historically,
they?
Historically, this interesting and important person lived in this place. I think I agree on that.
I've probably got this wrong, the exact address, but it's somewhere at Edmonton on the way to my son's school. Next to kebab shops is a plaque for John Keats, which I think is just, it's probably one of the most ugly streets you could ever imagine, but the idea that you could write Ode to a Nightingale there is sort of...
above a kebab shop.
Above a kebab shop.
I suspect the kebab shop may not have been...
Don't spoil
may
it.
Not have been there at the
Don't
time.
Spoil it,
no, but yeah, just the way in which an area can change, is, and it reminds you of that.
OK, thank you all. Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Jonathan Friedland, Dawn Foster and Patrick Winter. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.